Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Monday morning. It's January 12th. Currently 21 degrees and sunny here in Old Town Park City. Heber City reporting 19 degrees with sunshine. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Monday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch back as we go into a new week in January. Your Monday forecast will feature plenty of sunshine out there across the area. These temperatures a little above average as we see our numbers climbing into the mid-40s for us in Park City this afternoon. We'll see those highs climbing into the mid to upper 40s for us in the Heber Valley. Moving into tonight, look for clear skies. Temperatures dip back down into the low to mid-20s out there from Park City to the Heber Valley. We'll see our high temperatures climbing back into the mid-40s in Park City as we go throughout the day on your Tuesday with lots of sunshine. We'll see that hazy sunshine beginning to develop in the Heber Valley as that ridge of high pressure begins to create that inversion and helps to trap some of that haze in the valleys. Highs will only be in the upper 40s then as we go into your Tuesday afternoon. Moving into your Wednesday, we're looking at lots of sunshine in Park City. We'll stay above that haze layer, highs in the mid to upper 40s. Meanwhile, in the Heber Valley, we'll be well entrenched into that haze layer, and we'll see those temperatures holding also into the mid to upper 40s. Moving into the rest of your week on your Thursday, look for lots of sunshine, highs in the mid-40s in Park City on your Thursday. We'll see highs in the upper 40s for us in the Heber Valley with that hazy sunshine expected out there as well. Again, temperatures starting off in the teens and low 20s, climbing into the upper 40s in the Heber Valley on your Thursday. By Friday, we'll have lots of sunshine in Park City with those highs still in the mid-40s. Highs will be in the mid to upper 40s in the Heber Valley with hazy sunshine expected. We may see a weak system shift the winds just in time for the weekend. The only thing it's going to do is actually just get rid of the haze across the valley areas. But overall, we'll stay with very similar weather conditions. Lots of sunshine, mid-40s for us for highs Saturday and Sunday in the Park City area. And we'll see those highs in the upper 40s to near 50 in the Heber Valley. Overall, it looks dry and also on the mild side over the next 7 days. That's a look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
And with a look in the backcountry on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Center, we have Greg. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning. Thursday storm certainly changed things. And it was great because it finally gave us some mid-elevation snow. So I want to begin the avalanche forecast actually talking about how good conditions are right now. Northerly facing slopes still have some great riding and traveling conditions with cold, dry powder. Southerly aspects have a crust. Avalanche-wise, things are trending towards stability. We're continuing with a moderate avalanche danger at the mid and upper elevations. And I think on the sunny slopes, we call the solar slopes often, there's a chance for wet, loose avalanche activity today. I think there's still some rogue wind drifts. We had some winds on Friday and Saturday. I think there's some wind drifts at the upper elevations that could be sensitive. Particularly if they're on top of one of these buried weaker layers that we have. But we're trending towards stability, but still going with a moderate avalanche danger in some isolated areas, and that means human-triggered avalanches are possible. There was one avalanche reported from Saturday that did get my attention. This was in Upper Stairs Gulch. Looking at photos of it, it ran to the ground with a crown up to 5 feet. I'm uncertain if this was a glide avalanche. Stairs Gulch in the Salt Lake Mountains is known to have glide avalanches. I'm uncertain if this was a glide avalanche or if this was just an avalanche that failed in our buried persistent weak layer. Perhaps it was from a wind drift with a cornice fall. So I'm uncertain of that. The thing is that it's a reminder that avalanches are still possible. So, yeah, moderate danger. And, we're high and dry for quite a while, unfortunately. But, Thursday storm changed things, and we do have some decent coverage to the mid and upper elevations finally.
Okay, Greg, thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Stay tuned in just a minute. We'll be checking in with Summit County Health Department Director Phil Bondurant. Later on, Park City Mayor Ryan Dickey sharing with us his thoughts for his first 100 days in office. And with our winter sports update, we'll have Park City Ski and Snowboard Performance Sports Athletic Director Tommy Eckfeldt telling us about the upcoming Town Race Series, among other things. Once we've reported, the first case of measles was reported here in Summit County, and in the studio to discuss what that means, as well as a look ahead at the upcoming Climate Change Speaker Series, I have Summit County Health Department Director Phil Bondurant. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So why is one case of measles significant?
Yeah, that's a great question. But as we've reported in previous interviews, measles is the most contagious disease that we know of. And when we find it in a situation like we did this weekend in an elementary school in South Summit, there's a lot of exposures that occur with just one case. We know that measles, an individual with measles, is contagious 4 days before they start experiencing symptoms. So as in the case that we are working through right now, the child attended school and had no symptoms. It's very important that we clarify that this family did not send their child to school sick. In fact, the child was in good, appeared to be in good health and attended school and went through the normal day-to-day activities that you would expect an elementary school child to go through. However, during that period, they were contagious for measles. And so our concern is that for the other individuals inside of the school that are unvaccinated, there is a high likelihood that an exposure might have occurred and that they could also have contracted measles. And that's why we take even one case so seriously. We want to make sure that if others were exposed, that we provide them an opportunity to be home and to make sure that we are on symptom watch, but also that we don't continue to expose other children inside of the school. Now, if your child is vaccinated, even with one vaccine, there's a high level of protection for that child. And this goes for all schools. This is not just focused on South Summit, but for all schools across the state and across the nation, one vaccine is estimated to provide 93% protection against measles. If you have both parts of the MMR vaccine series, you're upwards of 97% protected. We know this vaccine works, and therefore, if your child is vaccinated or you as a staff member or a family member are vaccinated and exposed, we encourage you just to kind of keep an eye on those symptoms, but to continue with your day and with life as you normally would. It's really our unvaccinated population that we want to protect and look after in this, and that's why one case is such a big deal for public health.
Yeah. So the child, it was January 5th, I think, when you just, I mean, is that when the child came down with the symptoms and realized something wasn't right?
No, we learned that the child was exposed through a family member that was found positive for measles during the holidays, and working closely with our school district, we asked the child to be removed from school, and the family has been extremely cooperative. They've been collaborative, willing to work with us in a very tough situation. This isn't easy. Nobody wants their child to be sick, and nobody wants to be a measles case. And so given the difficulty of the situation, they've been very willing to work with us. And even though the child was not symptomatic, did not show anything, felt fine on January 5th, they willingly pulled their child from school and then kept them home while we were on symptom watch. And unfortunately, that individual, knowing how contagious it is, did develop a measles case.
Mm-hmm. And at this point, nobody else as a result, but we're still within that 7 to 14 days of, right, symptoms actually showing up.
Yeah, and I cannot thank the South Summit School District enough. The school nurses there, the superintendent, even the families that are really dealing with this difficult side of a measles response. This isn't easy. It's not easy for anybody. And to what I know and what has been reported, there's frustration, absolutely, and that's understandable. But there's also an understanding of what needs to happen in order to protect the South Summit School District Elementary School and make sure that this doesn't get to be bigger than it should be.
Mm-hmm. So to limit cases, can the school district not allow children who are unvaccinated to come to school?
Yeah, that's probably one of the most difficult. Obviously, anytime you're ill, not feeling well, especially with measles, that's really difficult. It's always not fun when we don't feel good. But socially, it's really difficult that these children will be excluded from school for 21 days from the day of exposure. So these families, they have to take a step back and look at how they're going to really manage their lives and find care for their children until January 26th, because for 21 days, unvaccinated children are excluded from school to make sure that, one, they're on symptom watch at home, but two, we don't continue to spread measles around the school.
What if they went in and got a vaccine on January 6th? Would that help?
It would. It absolutely would. There is a period after exposure where certain medical, different treatments can be offered to limit that time, but unfortunately, we are outside of that window, and by the time we had the test results back that this was a positive measles case, and the families were notified, that window had expired and would not be available to those children.
All right, so those students are still excluded from school.
Students and staff. Yeah. And this is a really difficult part of this process. It's not something that public health looks forward to, but it is something that we stand by, as it's a proven process to make sure we're protecting not only school, not only children and staff, but the community as well.
Yeah, can you tell us how many kids are involved? How many staff members are involved in this?
Right now, that's still being determined, I believe, by the South Summit School District, but I think it was roughly 20 people have been contacted or 20 students and staff that have been contacted.
And you mentioned that it is the most contagious disease. What about COVID? I thought that was right up there too.
Yeah, absolutely. COVID was at its peak, and measles is what we measure against. If there's 10 people in a room and an individual with measles walks into a room of individuals that are unvaccinated, it's estimated that 9 out of 10 will become positive for measles or experience measles. And COVID was up there. The R-naught value was pretty high for COVID as well, but we've seen that over the last few years kind of decline, right? We've seen it shrink a little bit, whereas that R-naught value, which is a term we became familiar with during COVID, for measles has remained consistent through all research and the academic literature that describes measles symptoms, manifestation, those types of things. So while COVID has fluctuated a little bit in its terms of transmission and infection rates, those rates for measles have remained consistent, and it's very high.
Yeah, and certainly those that do get measles, may not feel well for a while. On the other hand, I was reading there is the possibility of death. There's also the possibility of encephalitis. What's that?
Yeah, encephalitis is a swelling of the brain. Right now in the state of Utah, there's 177 cases that I'm aware of for measles, and 17 in the state of Utah have been hospitalized. So 10% of the cases that we've seen have been hospitalized. Now that's a fairly high number, in my opinion, of individuals that have been hospitalized for measles. It can be, it generally can start out with fairly mild symptoms, the rash that we're all familiar with, some gastrointestinal type of symptoms, the fevers. It can progress to an earache, those types of things. But in more severe cases, it can progress into pneumonia, as you mentioned, encephalitis, hospitalization. There's a number of complications that occur in pregnant women who are unvaccinated. So those are worst case scenarios, and we don't ever want to find ourselves in that boat. But for something that's 100%, nearly 100%, preventable, it's really hard to hear that 10% of these cases have found themselves in the hospital.
All right, let's move on. January is National Radon Awareness Month, so what's the county doing about this?
Yeah, as we've done in the past, we're pushing out some information through our county newsletter, the health department newsletter. We'll have some information on the website, and we're fortunate enough to have this platform as well to share information about radon. In Utah and across the nation, radon is the number two cause of lung cancer, only behind tobacco smoke. And we have a high rate of radon in homes here in Summit County. Now, radon is a tasteless, odorless gas that occurs from the decay of uranium in our soil and finds its way through cracks in our foundations into the low-lying parts of our homes. And you won't taste it, you won't smell it, you can't tell it's there, but when we are exposed to it on a regular basis, it does present some very harmful outcomes. And so this month across the nation, local public health, state public health agencies are doing a lot to bring awareness to radon. And because we have found it in such high rates here in Summit County, we have a very robust web page on our summitcountyhealth.org website dedicated to radon. We have a radon specialist inside of our department. We offer tests at $10 that can be purchased there at our health department locations. And we have a heat map where individuals can go and look at where those tests have been conducted within a radius. We do not identify specific residences, but you can begin to see areas where clusters of radon have been higher than what that action threshold is, which is 4 picocuries per liter. When you exceed that, it's considered to be an actionable level, meaning that the presence of radon in your home is high enough that it could cause harm. And we use the information obtained through these tests to create heat maps, which allows individuals to look at their neighborhoods throughout the county and see what the radon levels look like there. And then, of course, we always encourage people to test every couple years to make sure that if you've had low levels, they remain that way. But if the levels of radon in your home exceed 4, that you're looking at a remediation system.
Mm-hmm. And again, that tracking of those hot spots is you're getting the information from those doing the test. So if we have a neighborhood not doing the test, it's going to show low, which in fact it may not be.
Absolutely. Yeah, it will show that there are just no tests there. The team has done a wonderful job of putting together this heat map in a really understandable way that if you're in an area where there's some positive tests there that exceed that threshold, you might want to look into having your home tested if you have not done so.
Okay, and if you, in fact, you do have it, things can be done to mitigate it.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We had radon in our home, and we went through the process of installing a remediation system and took those levels from, you know, the mid-teens down to sub 0.1. And the systems, they're a bit of a pain to install if your basement or the low-lying part of your home is already finished. But it's a good action to take to protect that downstairs, especially if you have kids or family or you yourself sleep in the basement. You're going to want to get that remediated as soon as possible.
All right. The Community Health Improvement Plan has been approved and available for the public to read. Remind us what the plan is.
Yeah, the Community Health Improvement Plan is really a couple years in the making. It's a methodical process that really captures the lived experiences of the community. We had over 25 organizations across the county represented that came together and really helped us determine between what the data tell us versus what the lived experience of our community is. And that's extremely important. We have access to data. The numbers will tell one story, but there's no personal nature behind that data. There's no lived experience. There's no individual accountability for what those data tell us. So this qualitative experience really helps us understand exactly what our community feels we should be focusing on. And so when you think about High Valley Transit and Swanner Eco Center and, you know, the clubhouses there and the Community Foundation, these are organizations that are boots on the ground working with our most vulnerable populations. And they are there sharing experiences on how health equity can be better addressed inside of Summit County. And really that's what the CHIP is intended to do, is focus on finding ways to take our resources that are allocated to us through the County Council and create the greatest outcomes in our community. And I'm really excited about it. It's available both in English and Spanish. It's easy to read. It's visually appealing. It's going to guide our department with 3 strategic priorities through 2030, and it's something that I know the team is really excited about as well.
What are those 3 priorities?
Yeah. First, we want to strengthen partnerships to impact community health drivers. Second, we want to improve food and nutrition access for an evolving community. And 3, we want to increase immunization coverage to reduce preventable disease.
Okay. Now, this came to the Board of Health. Did they make any changes or?
Yeah, absolutely. The Board of Health was well represented back in July of 2025 when we started this process. And as the team continued to work and refine and edit this, the Board of Health was critical in helping us really define what these priorities should look like, using the right language, the right terminology, to get to a point where in December when the final product was presented, not only were they comfortable with what was being proposed, but they were on board with what was being proposed. And what I mean by that is, it's one thing to have a plan, but it's a different thing to enact a plan. And the Board of Health will be key in getting this plan off the ground and running for the next 5 years.
All right. Well, as you can look out our window, Sundance is coming. How is this keeping the health department busy?
It always does. We have, in speaking with our environmental health team, we anticipate we'll have about 40 food permits, plus a couple of mass gathering permits that we will be out Thursday through Sunday inspecting, making sure that those who are attending have the safest, best possible experience they can related to Sundance. It's an opportunity for us also to revisit our partnerships with Park City Municipal, with our law enforcement agencies, with fire and EMS. It's really a good opportunity to get out, kind of stretch our legs to start the year and make sure that we have the right contacts, that we can be of service and support to those agencies that need it most, and keeping the event safe, sanitary, and that people are here and they can have a good time. This year, being that it's the last in Park City, we reached out to Boulder County, where the Sundance will be going, to their environmental team and invited them to come out and be a part of this event. We really wanted to make sure that any environmental health team that does this kind of work has an opportunity to be prepared and not caught off guard. And so we're still coordinating with Boulder County to get some environmental health scientists out here to visit these spots and do these inspections with us, so that in 2027, when they have the unique opportunity to be involved in the Sundance experience, that they're well prepared and that they too can keep the event safe and sanitary for everybody attending.
Okay. My guess is that fees are charged to do these inspections?
Absolutely. Yeah. And Sundance's and the vendors have always been good about understanding the importance of those fees to cover the cost of doing this, so that the money we receive to do our programming from County Council is for those efforts that are focused on what impacts everybody versus special events where it's a very select population. We make sure that those fees cover the cost of us being in the area to do those inspections.
And I'm guessing it's just not that much of a deal that it would impact your budget next year by not collecting these fees.
No, not at all, because when Sundance does leave Park City and this weekend, we will just have other work to do, right? We'll have other inspections to do. And so if the fees are not there to cover the cost of doing this work, the work plan just will not reflect the Sundance inspections.
Okay. And then finally, some quick reminders about climate change and public health.
Yeah. So this has been a wildly successful speaker series that's put on by our sustainability team. We're going into the fourth year of doing this, which is it's crazy to think that that's where we're at. But as we continue to do this and we meet a couple times a year to talk about climate change and public health and how that impacts our individual health moving forward, we want to make sure that we're covering the topics that the community wants to hear. One, because we want the community to attend, but two, we want it to remain relevant and interesting. So we have a survey out right now. You can find that survey link on our website if you are one that attends the symposium or speaker series. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear about different topics that you'd like to learn about. To date, we've covered water, and we've covered mental health and climate change, and we've covered what it means for our agricultural community moving forward and the practices they use to weather the uncertain climate change and impacts that we experience, and really all interesting topics that have throughout the different venues captured a different audience. It's not the same audience every time, and we want to continue to serve in that role where we can capture topics that are interesting to a variety of people. And so that's really what the survey is intended to do, is allow individuals that might have a specific topic they want to hear about, let us find some professionals, bring everybody together, and have an honest down-to-earth conversation about what that means and help the community feel educated on these topics.
Okay. Do they just call you up?
They can call 435-333-1500, or they can go right to the website, summitcountyhealth.org, and we'll have a link to the survey right there on the homepage.
Okay. Phil, see you next month. Thank you.
Thank you.
Phil Bondurant, again, is the director of the Summit County Health Department. Well, as we reported, Mayor Ryan Dickey and incumbent council member Tana Tolley and newcomer Diego Zagar were sworn into office a week ago. Mayor Dickey joins me now in the studio. Good morning. Thanks
Good
for being
morning.
Here. adorable photo on the front page of the Park Record with your two daughters and wife. What do your daughters think about all this? Do they know what's going down?
Oh, yeah. They love this. They loved every minute of it from the campaign to the end. Of course, I'm their dad, so there's no chance I won't win, you know. I can do no wrong. So they thought the campaign was flawless.
Yeah. So was that a difficult decision, though, for you to run for office, knowing that, you know, the kids could take a back seat to the new job?
It was. It was something we thought really hard about, and actually, you know, I got some advice to actually really bring your kids into the decision process. So actually, I was really intentional about having conversations with them. I mean, they were 6 and 8, but still they understood, and I was able to ask them, hey, this is going to mean some time away, and what do you think? And, you know, kids, even at that age, they had complicated opinions about it and asked a lot of questions, but they went forward, and once they were in, they were in. They love passing out swag and talking to people. They're two very outgoing kids, so they loved meet and greets, and they had a blast.
Great. Not that I know, but I mean, the office gets redecorated with whatever you want to hang on the walls, and you know where the coffee machine and the microwave are. How much time do you expect to spend in the office each day?
You know, I don't know. I think it'll probably ebb and flow. You know, it's not designed to be a full-time job, but it's certainly, it's probably going to feel that way, you know, where we have, where I've got probably a few different jobs. I think you'll see me in the office a great deal.
Yeah. Now, I believe Mayor Nan Worrell held office hours, as other mayors have. Do you plan to do those, and have those been set?
They're not set probably after February, but I plan to continue that same tradition. I mean, it's, you know, it's something that's efficient for the mayor, and it's also efficient for the public to be able to, you have a lot of folks who want to meet and have coffee, and you don't have a lot of, you know, hour block to say, hey, come to office hours, let me set up 15, 20 minutes with you, talk about what your issue is. So I plan to continue that.
Okay. Well, let's talk about your first 100 days. And I kind of looked up why this seems to be such a significant mark of time.
Oh,
and
good.
We can credit President Franklin Delano Roosevelt for
starting
it.
It's his fault? Okay.
Well, and again, and so these first 100 days have used as a benchmark to set kind of the tone for an administration to demonstrate leadership and to capitalize on early political capital and public goodwill before you piss anybody off. So besides replacing your seat on the city council, because we'll get into that in a minute, but what are your top three priorities for these first 100 days?
Well, obviously the city manager, you know, that's the biggest challenge ahead. And you really, you know, you feel it when you're in the building that, you know, Matt's the ghost of Matt Dias's old office is empty. So putting that city manager in place is critical to really moving things forward. And then I've outlined two things that, you know, in the near term and, you know, maybe before 100 days are critical to me. And that's finalizing our vision for the 248 corridor. So we had a work session on that last week. It's back on the 20th. We really got to be able to go to the state and federal government and working through the Olympics Committee. If we want to prioritize that project to say, you know, big transportation projects are what the Olympics can really help with. They've asked us pretty directly. We heard it in the listening session with the Olympic CEO, Brad Wilson. You know, we need to know what you need. What is your plan? And that needs to be a Wasatch back plan. So we've made good progress on that. I think we'll be able to accomplish that here early in the year. And then the second piece is defining our vision for the infamous, I guess at this point, 5-acre parcel, formerly known as the Arts and Culture District. You know, we just have to have a plan for that. And I've been pretty open about my preference really being to have a vision beyond any specific, you know, real strong policy preference I bring around what it is, but just more that it's community space. And if that's the road we're on now, you know, mixed use, a little bit of housing and retail and commercial and public gathering space, great. If that's a park, that's great. It just can't be what it is today, just not serving anyone. So my priority is to really push the council to put something concrete on paper for that piece of land.
Do you need to wait for, I'm guessing, the fifth council member?
Well, I think it'll just, the timing will work out for that anyway, for when Brinshore plans to come back.
Okay. And certainly getting that fifth council member on board is critical. Moving forward, you've got 10 applicants. And is the plan to interview all of them, no matter their qualifications?
We will interview all of them. We have 10 applicants. It actually looks like a very strong group on paper. A lot of folks who are well known in town. Also a few names that I didn't know, which, you know, doesn't mean much. We'll interview all of them, and you know, the council will ultimately you know, make that decision. I keep getting asked about it. I think people are used to sort of the planning commission boards and commissions model, where I come in with a name and there's sort of an up or down vote and discussion. This is not an advice and consent process. It is the council's nomination. So one of the council members from the floor will make a motion to nominate someone. There will be discussion, and the council will take a vote, and I'll vote in the case of a tie, just like any other business that we do.
Okay. Well, and being on a board, a commission, certainly served you well, right, as you were appointed.
I thought so. I mean, there's, you know, the basics of being in a public meeting and having the public sitting there staring at you and knowing how to read a packet. And that stuff serves you well.
Yeah. Will the questions be all the same to each of the candidates?
I think it will be like the Planning Commission, where we'll have a set of questions, and the council members and myself can just sort of can pick from among them. But it'll be a pretty tailored list of questions. Council members will also have the ability to ask follow-up questions from the written applications, as sort of a blanket. Can you expand more on something that they've put in writing?
All right, so there is some public support that the council, in quotation marks, should appoint Jack Rubin, who ran against you for the mayor's office. Is that all it takes to be a good council member to run for office?
Well, there are a lot of good council members who haven't served on boards and commissions, and they run for council because they're animated by an issue or this thing or that thing, and they become great council members. So I don't think there really is any specific qualification that you have to have.
Yeah. So what qualities or experiences are you personally looking for?
I'm looking for someone who I think can show they've put in some work, and that doesn't mean necessarily that you've been on a board and commission, but that you've certainly shown up for the community, that you've just been engaged in the public process. It would be great to have seen you at some meetings, some sense that this isn't just an opportunity to sort of get on city council without doing the work of campaigning. Doesn't mean I have to know your name, but that you've been around and you've shown a commitment to public service that just goes beyond reading the paper. Probably be nice, especially with just a 2-year term. Someone, you don't want to have a 2-year ramp up to kind of knowing what's going on, and then you're running for office again. Being able to get up to speed quickly is important. And I think someone who I think shows that they're aligned to sort of the council and city values. You know, we have a pretty clear set of priorities that we're working on. So, of course, I'm looking for someone that personally, as one, you know, member of the council, as it were, someone who sort of shares my priorities and values for the cities and some of the issues that I campaigned on.
Yeah. So you do feel that the replacement would align with your vision?
Yeah, I'd like that. I think that what I heard during the campaign was some frustration from the community that things just weren't moving forward, that things seemed pretty stuck. So I'm looking to, build cohesion and build a cohesive vision among the council to take some votes that will be probably hard at times, but to simply move some things forward. So it's not, I don't think it's, hey, we need to introduce more, more things to gum up the works. It's let's find someone who's ready to get things done and move things forward.
All right, let's talk just a little bit about your leadership style. I mean, I guess, what do you see as your greatest strength as a leader?
Good question. It's probably hard to articulate. I take a lot of pride in being pretty straightforward and honest with people. I think I've led a lot of teams in my career, and I think what I've generally gotten back from those teams is I tend to be pretty trustworthy, mean what I say, sort of stand up for the people who are on teams. So I'm a pretty straightforward leader. Part of that is I've always created things to do outside of one job. I've sort of always had a few jobs. I like to fill my time with things to do for better or worse. I just haven't had time for a lot of just sort of, you know, drama, for lack of a better word. I like to come to work and get the work done. We have a couple phrases we use in our business. One is, we like to have our meetings in the meeting. So, you know, you go to a meeting and you sit there and everyone talks in the meeting and then folks at the end scatter. And then it's like the real meeting happens after the meeting and say, well, they talked about what everyone said and what really happened. And we tell our staff, let's have the meeting in the meeting. So a really straightforward leadership style I like to bring. And I think I'm good at, I have enough of an EQ to at least kind of understand what different folks on a team need and their priorities and try to bring people together. I think I've had some success there. So building bridges with the council members and bringing an agenda that I think can satisfy all the different reasons that brought people to run for council and serve on council.
Yeah. And I guess what message do you have then for those residents who may be a bit skeptical or unsure of your leadership direction in terms of, you know, building bridges? Of course, you know, you're winning the election by 7 votes.
Yeah, they can judge me by the results. I probably talked for 6 months about it. They're probably tired of hearing me talk about it as much as let's see how you do it. So I think the results will speak for themselves.
Okay. And in terms of hiring a new city manager, as you mentioned, it's going for the council replacement. It is a council motion and vote. Is that different with the city manager? Because I think that might be one of your prerogatives to hire both a city manager and city attorney?
Yes. So the manager and attorney report to the council and mayor, but when it comes to the hiring of the city manager, at least, I believe the city attorney works the same. That is advice and consent. So I'll put forward a name to the council, but the council will be involved during the interview process. So it won't be as if they have a name sprung on them. The council will interview the top candidates. You know, I'm sitting in the building. I'll have probably the most direct influence in the process. But the council is very much involved. It doesn't just happen at the end.
All right. I believe the application is out for the city manager. Do you have a timeline that you can run through with us, or?
If I try to give you the timeline, I'll probably screw it up. But the application is open. I think it closes close to the end of the month. And then we'll start sort of the initial screening process, which will happen through our the third party that we have, really a phenomenal recruiter who does exactly this as his job, hiring city managers, tons of experience in the Mountain West. I've been really impressed with him. I think the final round interviews will probably happen towards the end of February, and we'll make some kind of an offer we'd expect to after that. From what I understand, we've had tremendous interest in the position. So, you know, there are challenges in recruiting someone to move to Park City in a very expensive place to live. And we've put together, I think, a really attractive, book to describe the position. We're offering, housing for a couple years, being able to leverage, one of our properties that we were to develop a Woodside Phase 1. So our housing investment's paying off there. So it's a great job. I sort of wondered a little bit, what the interest would be. It's obviously a great job, but you can go on Zillow and look at how expensive it is to live here and wonder if this is the right move. And from what I understand, it's attracted just a ton of interest.
Yeah.
So it's great.
And I guess, so best case scenario, end of March to have somebody named, do you think?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, it probably depends on when you make what's the employment situation when you extend that offer. So we have folks who will be in all different sorts of employment contracts and, just not sure exactly when they'll be able to start. But that's the time frame, probably March, April.
Okay, and I think for the city council replacement, I think you've got a special meeting on Tuesday the 20th to name that person?
On Tuesday, we're going to interview all 10. And then 2 days later at the council meeting on Thursday, we'll actually vote on the replacement.
Okay, and again, people are welcome to join in online to listen to those interviews.
It's just like any public meeting; they can join in person, or if they don't want to do the full slog, they can join online.
Okay, and I guess before I let you go, looking beyond the first 100 days, any other longer term projects or policies you hope to lay the groundwork floor? I know, we got the Olympics coming, but you were very involved with the whole Main Street area plan, which has basically disappeared from agendas and such.
Yeah, well, it hasn't disappeared entirely. We do have a circulation study in progress with Sweet Alley and Main Street. That'll be coming back. But yeah, that's very much a small slice of what that plan was. So I think there will be work maybe later in the year to think about a broader view of what's the next turn on that Main Street area plan. You know, we didn't pass that plan, so we really don't have one. We have a senior center on our agenda just this week, so that's another one I could have thrown in that 100 days. I'm looking for us to really decide what exactly are we trying to build, then we got to figure out how to fund it. You know, there's so much going on. There's really no shortage of things that'll come on our agenda.
Yeah. Speaking of the agenda, I know that there is a trial set for January 29th dealing with Park City Municipal and Matthew Prince and the home on the hill. Prior to that, though, there is an opportunity for some kind of settlement. As we know from last year's state legislative session, City Council can adjudicate things like that, development properties like that. What's happening there? Is that something that's going to be on the agenda, some kind of settlement agreement?
Yes. So the council's really always had the ability to settle something like this. There was the change in state law is really about whether it needs to come back through the Planning Commission. It's sort of, you know, councils have always been able to settle lawsuits. That's on our agenda for Thursday. Obviously, you know, you would expect that's not something that has just popped up here at the start of the year. But yeah, so there is a settlement agreement on the agenda, and the council will talk more about that. I know you have, you know, staff coming in this week. So, you know, big picture, since I've been on council, really going back to the start of when I was appointed, we've been in this sort of 3-year defense of our historic district, and you've seen us at the legislature fighting back on attempts to, you know, take away any sort of local control around the historic district. That defense has been successful and really hard. I mean, at times feeling like it was gonna go away and making the decision, hey, this is just the right thing. We have a house that doesn't meet code, standing up for our process, standing up for the code. After 3 years, we now have a house that, you know, was approved by the Planning Commission, upon appeal approved by the appeals panel. We have the design of the house that was appealed by our planning director. And then we had a board of adjustment and a split vote that that said it didn't for a couple reasons. So we're faced with a decision here, you know, going to the legislative session of, you know, there's always that. The question is, we've got a house that has been, you know, determined to meet the code in the ways I just described. You know, always, what's the right decision for local control? And so that settlement agreement will be before the council on Thursday.
Yeah, and we've got the house under development and under kind of an at-risk clause. But I guess I would ask, why settle when we have a court trial on it 2 weeks later?
Well, there are multiple lawsuits related to the house. There are two lawsuits with the city and the two private parties. There's also a lawsuit between the private parties that does not involve the city. I don't think it would be realistic for that this entire matter to be settled next week. So I think, you know, the settlement discussions always make sense when you're in a lawsuit. When you find you might be at a point where it makes sense to stop, but that's something that again will be a I'm still getting used to not having a vote, but that's going to be a council vote, and I'm part of that council on Thursday, I would expect.
Okay, that's your job, is to round up the posse.
Yes.
Mayor, anything else that you'd like to say to our listeners?
No, I think, thank you. It's fun to get started. The swearing in on Monday was great. My family has enjoyed it. The campaign, for the most part, was great. It was great to meet so many new people, even knocking on doors. It just, you know, the campaign was fun end to end, went a little longer than, you know, anybody would have liked, but it's just fun to be done talking about it and just getting to the work.
Okay, good luck.
All right, thanks, Leslie.
That's Park City Mayor Ryan Dickey. Utah health leaders are warning parents of a growing area of concern. Youth use of nicotine pouches is on the rise statewide. KPCW's Christine Muller reports Summit County students are following the trend.
According to the 2025 Student Health and Risk Prevention Survey, there was a 300% increase in Utah youth who used nicotine pouches to try tobacco for the first time. That's an increase from 1.6% in 2023 to 3.4% in 2025. Summit County Health Department health educator Matt Walbach says the increase may be because there are more state regulations related to vaping.
most flavored vapes are not legally sold in the state of Utah. The only ones that are legally allowed to be purchased are tobacco and menthol flavored vapes.
He said the nicotine pouches, which can contain flavorings as well as nicotine powder, are also more accessible for youth than vapes. In Summit County, there was an almost 122% increase in student lifetime use of the addictive smokeless tobacco products, increasing from 3.7% in 2023 to 8.2% of students in 2025. And while the percentage of use isn't as high as vaping, alcohol, or marijuana, in fact, youth substance abuse is decreasing statewide, health leaders say nicotine pouches are something to be aware of. Walbach said the biggest concern is addiction. Nicotine causes much more dopamine than normal to be released, which affects youth brain development and causes addiction.
Some youth initially, they kind of start taking it to try to help manage stress and anxiety. But we see really quickly that backfires and it turns into another stressor.
Walbach said there is also evidence the pouches cause gum recession and other damage to the mouth, though there isn't much long-term data on the products. Packaging on the pouches can also be tricky.
I think the biggest thing with nicotine pouches is they're marketed usually as tobacco-free, so that has the view that it could be less harmful, but we're still seeing the harm from it, and it's still synthetic nicotine being used.
Walbach said the county works with local schools and district leaders to educate students on the risks of nicotine pouch use. That includes giving classroom presentations and resources for students caught with nicotine products on campus. However, Walbach said the best way to prevent any substance use is for parents to talk to their kids and set expectations at about 9 years old. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
The new snow and cooler temperatures, Park City Ski and Snowboard ready to launch this year's popular Town Race Series. On the phone with details on this, as well as how we've got the teams doing, I have Performance Sport Athletic Director at Park City Ski and Snowboard, Tommy Eckfeldt. Good morning, Tommy.
Morning, Leslie. How you doing?
Doing great. Thanks. So when's the first race of the series?
First race is January 23rd.
Okay.
Friday.
All right. And they are held where?
They're held at the Utah Olympic Park on the Intermediate Hill or Highway Lift, the small hills, as everyone likes to call them. And, yeah, we're going to be getting ready to go here shortly next week. We've got UOP has done a great job getting additional cover on that trail so we can host those races and kick off the season. And so we've got great coverage over there now, and we're just getting ramped up.
Okay, so this is one of how many in the series?
We've got four races. We try to spread it out over the winter with one race series every month. It's a mix of both alpine racing and ski-mo. So the ski mountaineering portion, which is debuting in this Olympics coming up next month, does have its own little race series as well. You can compete in either or a combination of both and try to participate in the whole event. But it happens once a month.
Okay. And you mentioned it's on the highway run as opposed to the big steep game changer runs over there.
Yeah, we try to make it a little bit more friendly for the community, but we've always hosted our Town Series races on the Intermediate Hill just because the length is actually really conducive to good, solid racing and fun for basically all ability levels.
Okay, how many different divisions do you have? Because I know we're running a public service announcement talking about the Olympians who show up. Nobody wants to race them.
Yeah, no, we've got, it's really fun to be able to race with former Olympians and, you know, former NCAA All-Americans, just come out and rub elbows because they are part of our community too. But our new events director, Brent Greigel, he's got a fun new way of kind of altering the point system so that it's more team and community focused. It allows people to get points in a bracketed fashion. So basically, if you get first place, you get 10th place, you get the same number of points. People have tried for years within the system, try to game it, but it really ends up not really benefiting them. So kind of how you stack your team and how you end up placing, it gives, you know, more fun for everyone to kind of just base it. It's almost like a handicapping system.
Sure. Okay, people can register at parkcityss.org. Wanted to just note on the calendar, it looks like you have a number of freestyle, jumping, and alpine races coming up. With the lack of snow, is this an issue?
You know, we were obviously, like everybody else, you know, pretty worried, but our resort partners and venues have done a really good job in trying to just crank and make snow when they can. As we know, it hasn't been for a lack of trying. All of our resorts are seeing, you know, reduced capacities right now, and they're all just trying to get back to where they want to be. And we can't thank them enough for trying to just get back to, you know, really putting our venues in place, especially the Olympic Park. We meet with them every morning to just to discuss, you know, weekly where the snowmaking capacity is going to go, where it's going to look like, and how it's going to impact our events and our venues. So they're doing everything they can to get us up and running.
Sure. And has that impacted then athlete training because of just the lack of snow?
For all of our base programs, no, it hasn't at all, because they really started right in the beginning of January. A lot of our earlier season programs that started in December, we had limited capacity, so we were you know, allowing, working with places like Woodward to do some free ride and free ski type stuff and training. We were working with our Nordic programs to kind of be skiing on frosted grass and limited snow, both at Ecker, as well as trying to tap in and utilize more Soldier Hollow. So we've really tried to be flexible in where we can to continue to keep our programs running. Now, I will say, obviously, some of our highest level programs, our elite level programs for our oldest athletes, they have needed, you know, consistent and better, you know, in top-notch services that were up to racing and competition spec. And so they've had to obviously move to where the competitions have changed, you know, geared up in around the country and around North America.
Okay. Got to leave it at that, but it does look like you're looking for volunteers to help with some of the competitions. People can find out more, again, by going to parkcityss.org. Hey, Tommy, thanks for your time.
Hey, thanks a lot, Leslie.